Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the main course on heritageradionetwork.org. I am your host, Alexis McLaughlin, and here as always with Philip Gilmore.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
I guess it technically is. We always say good morning.
Yeah.
It feels like morning.
It feels like morning.
I just woke up.
That's some serious radio voice.
Yeah, man.
You're really turning it on.
Yeah, man.
You're Barry White in every way except for one.
It's almost February.
We've kind of been away from the studio for a few weeks.
Yeah, we've been busy.
Yeah, I guess. And the studio was on hiatus. Mm-hmm. They did their fund drive, which was exceptionally successful this year. I think they raised over $100,000, which is pretty incredible.
It's awesome.
I don't know. What else has been going on since then?
Just been working.
Yeah. Everything's going well.
Slipping on ice, hurting my leg. I was sick for about a week, but I was sick for about 2 weeks.
Going out, staying out too late?
No. I've been very good lately, but I was I haven't been sick in a long time, and it was like just, but it was weird. It was like a cough. It was yeah. So that's enough about me and my ailments.
No, really. Please continue.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. How do you really feel?
I feel great today. Okay. The coffee is hitting me.
So. Oh, good. Yeah.
So we are here with my friend, my good friend, Garo Yellen.
Good morning. Talented musician.
Yes.
Native New Yorker.
Native New Yorker.
Renaissance man.
Renaissance man.
I try.
Squash player.
Really?
Yes. Competitive squash player. Maybe one of the best in the world. I tell people.
It's always annoying when people say that.
What?
Because then I have to say something bad about myself.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. As opposed to if you said, he's really not that good, and I can be, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Okay. Mediocre squash player.
Wait. I'm a horrible human being, though. Yes.
In a small part of the amateur world, I'm not that bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How does one become a squash player? Did you just grow up playing squash, or
you have to go to an Ivy League school,
mm-hmm.
Where the sexual abuse scandals are covered for decades.
Yes,
and then finally, like an altar boy, it all comes pouring out of you,
mm-hmm.
And that revelation leads you to profound realizations,
mm-hmm.
That can only be, you know, really. No psychology can help you. You really need to work it out through a kind of mano a mano faux combat.
Yes.
Yeah.
On the squash courts.
Yes.
On squash.
Is it a court? Can we explain a little bit?
By the way,
I
didn't go to an Ivy League school.
Yeah.
And I, despite all my efforts, was never abused.
Oh, well, he didn't go to Ivy League school. He only went to Juilliard, which is way below Ivy League. I believe.
I didn't really. You know, have any of those experiences?
Yes.
But that, I'm just
a girl can dream, though.
I'm giving you the traditional path to squash greatness.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is a common thread that all squash players have.
Yeah. Yes. I took a sideways path to squash mediocrity.
I don't even know how you play squash. I don't know what the implement is.
How much time do we have?
Okay,
that's too much.
15 seconds.
Actually, I do want to know one thing. What? Because the thing, it's not like a tennis ball or racquet ball. It's like this little hard rubbery thing. What is the thing called?
This is it in a nutshell. It's got a small ball that is very dead when you pick it up.
Yeah.
That's why, hence squash, because it squishes when it hits the wall.
Yeah.
Yet it can travel at up to 180 miles an hour through the air. So it's got the irony of being a super fast game that requires fast turn-on-a-dime reflexes, incredible endurance, and speed with a ball that does not bounce very far.
Yeah.
Hence, you have to go to it,
as
opposed to it coming to you.
Yeah.
And it's one of the top aerobic sports after soccer.
Really?
Yeah.
And rugby.
And rugby, which is
brutal.
What's a word that means something other than aerobic and possibly possibly fatal.
Turtlish?
You got to dig deeper.
Okay, so let's talk about this.
You know, us Americans are really up on the rugby.
Yeah, exactly, yes. I have nothing to say about rugby. It seems like a horrible sport. Let me ask you a question. Your father was a musician?
My father was a musician, yes.
Yes.
Correct.
And what did he teach?
He was a musicologist.
What was his name?
And a composer, Victor Yellen.
Did I ever meet him?
I think that you had met him many, many years ago. He died in 2005. But you definitely met him.
At Alioli, probably?
Yes, at Alioli and out in when we first moved out to Williamsburg in those days. Yeah.
I've known Garo. Do you prefer Garo? I call you Garo, but
my parents called me Garo.
Yeah.
A lot of people call me Garo. Yeah. I decided very early on in life that I'm not going to be that person who spends half their life correcting people about the pronunciation
of their
name.
Yes.
Really, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, Ahmed or Ahmed.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I feel flexible.
I think we're going on our year 16, you and I.
It's our sweet 16.
It's our sweet 16. Yeah, we've known each other 16 years.
Oh, really?
Where did you guys meet?
I'm going to buy a new dress.
I know Alioli. We hung out. I worked at a Spanish topless place called Alioli in 2000. But did we possibly meet at Diner in 99?
Probably, yeah. Cause I knew Andrew.
And Mark.
Yeah, from back then when they first opened the only restaurant you could eat in Williamsburg.
Yeah. we've actually had a couple guests on here that, you know, were around that time, and then we kind of go down memory lane, and somebody always brings up something that I would never have remembered, but like Osnott's dish.
I know.
Yeah.
It was awesome, and because everything was priced about 75 cents above what people felt like they should pay.
Yeah, exactly.
It couldn't quite survive the early days out in Williamsburg.
And then also the food at Black Betty wasn't bad.
Yep, very good.
Which is now the Commodore, but Black Betty was this, like, just total, like, you know, dive bar, cocaine spot. But, like, you know, you'd go in there on, like, a Friday, and, like, TV on the radio would be playing, and there'd be, like, 18 people listening to them, you know? like, quite literally.
Right, they were playing in the back in the corner?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So your dad, he was a music teacher?
My father went, fought in World War II, fought the Battle of the Bulge in World War II.
Wow.
Has a lot of interesting war stories, came back, and on the GI Bill, he had gone to Boston Latin School, and then between that and the GI Bill, was able to go get a free ride through Harvard, where he went and got 3 degrees.
Wow.
And he was a composer and actively pursued composing for a number of years. And by the time I was old enough to really appreciate that fact, he had already slipped into being more of an academic and a professor. Had taught at Harvard and Williams, and then ended up at NYU. But I remember in a musty, old, rotten, mildewed, probably I have permanent lung disease from having opened this filing cabinet, I found a bunch of old articles, including the cover of the art section of the Times from sometime in the mid-60s. And it said New York's most promising young composers.
Really?
There's a big picture of my father
on
the cover, and he had just won a competition to have parts of his opera recorded by the Metropolitan Opera, and he was, you know, starting to have some success. But, you know, I was shocked because I didn't know him as that at all. And then years later I said, what's going on? You know, I started to find music he had written, and he wrote a musical when he was teaching, I think, at a girls' school for briefly, when he was just married to my mother, and she wrote the libretto, and it takes place in a drugstore, and it's called Prescription for Judy. And it has hilarious, great music and dance sequences in that, and he was a serious classical composer, but he wrote this thing that was kind of a little bit like, you know, in the same way that, like, maybe like Bernstein would write a musical. It had a sort of, you know, seriousness to it, but it was also fun.
Yeah.
And I found this grand opera he wrote based on the story of the medieval 12th century forbidden love affair of Abelard and Heloise.
Wow.
That ends and this is a real story that in reality ended with a 11th hour castration scene. I mean, he wrote this grand opera, which is amazing. And parts of that got recorded by the Met and were all destroyed in reel-to-reel tapes in a flood.
Really?
So there's no record of it, but I have the score.
Oh, and, wow.
But I didn't really know him as a composer. I knew him as a professor. And then I started grilling him. And then I pushed him in, later in life to write more works, which he did.
Wow.
Yeah.
And did you ever actually play with him?
He also knew everything about everything. Like, yeah. If I ever asked him a question, like one question about like a king of England, you'd have to go back to Ethelred in 520 and have an hour and a half for the answer, which I didn't quite appreciate enough back then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now I'm like a pale version of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So your name is from Lithuania, you said? Your name, Yellen?
I love the mockery.
Yeah. No, I know.
The mockery.
But how many generations out was he from Armenia?
No, my mom was Armenian.
Your mom was Armenian?
Yeah,
okay.
Apostolic Christian Armenian. Her grandfather was an archbishop in the Armenian Apostolic Church.
I don't know her last name, but I bet it ends in I-A-N.
It did. Her the original family last name was Vemian. Hey. My mom's name was Isabel. And I love this, even though it's not spelt quite right. It's Satanic, which is basically looks like Satanic.
Oh, Satanic.
Vemian.
Yeah.
It really does sound like it should be a Star Wars villain.
It sounds like Andrew LaVey's wife.
Yeah. And my father's family were Jews from the Polish-Russian border, literally from the town of Bialystok.
Wow.
Yeah.
like the guy from the producers.
Most people think that was a made up place.
Yeah. I've never heard of it. Is that real? Wow, that's amazing. You know the
from the producers.
Yeah, Bialystok.
Yeah.
Well, that's neat. I thought your dad was Armenian. I thought Yellen was actually Armenian for some reason. No,
nope.
I was correct.
That's kind of more of the Russian Polish border, kind of. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably a fake name to avoid conscription, but. Mm-hmm.
Between Garo and my friend Harag, who used to be my next door neighbor, do you know hyperallergic?
No,
it's like one of the top art. You know, like Harag's killing it. He has his website is like considered one of the top like art blogs in the world.
Oh, wow.
You should check it out. It's called Hyperallergic. But I was, at the time when I moved to New York, I was living next door to Harag, and he was actually the editor of the AGBU, which is the Armenian General Benevolence Union. AGBU, yes. It's the Armenian General Benevolence Union, but I'm like a walking, like he kind of deprogrammed me of things I didn't even know about. about the whole Armenian genocide. So I'm like a walking textbook.
I've read a lot of books about Armenia because it's kind of an interesting subject to me. But one book I sort of was avoiding because it seemed to have not been written by someone with scholarly credentials is a book called Project or Operation Nemesis by Eric Bogosian, the playwright and actor.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite good and quite well researched.
Isn't it recently?
It came out recently, and it's about after the Armenian genocide.
Mm-hmm.
These groups of sort of self-funded bakers and newspaper publishers started a network of collecting money to fund basically hit squads to go out and track down the escaping war criminals from Turkey, many of whom had been tried in absentia and sentenced to death. And these semi-amateurs spent months or years staking out, planning the assassinations of the perpetrators of the genocide, and managed to pull off almost all the important people. Almost all of them got assassinated. And the most famous one was broad daylight in a street in Berlin, 1921. Talat Pasha, who was the head of the Turkish triumvirate who orchestrated the genocide, was shot in the head by Sagman Talarian in broad daylight, arrested, tried in Germany, and even though he admitted premeditated political assassination, was acquitted.
Really?
Yeah, because of the testimony that was allowed in about what the guy did.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny how from 1921 to 1939, how much could change in a country.
Yeah. Eric Bogosian was on Mark Maron's show, and I listened to it. But I had no idea about that. And it's such a great story. But the book is worth reading.
I would recommend it to anyone who's interested in that era or period of World War One intrigue.
Yeah. And,
what was it called again?
It's called Operation Nemesis, I believe. And that was the name of the group, which is so Bond villain. These Armenian assassination squads were part of like Operation Nemesis. You know, it's like, where's the bald guy stroking the hairless cat? You know?
in your pocket.
Yeah. He ate it because it's a food show.
Yeah, exactly. Have you ever eaten food?
I've eaten food, and I'm anticipating being eaten myself.
Oh, yes, that's right. Not to promote your agenda, your secret agenda, but not to out you, but I have to talk. I'm a journalist. I have to, be honest with you. He is on the ground floor of a movement to have cannibalism legalized.
I'm not trying to legalize cannibalism. I think it's coming.
Yeah.
And I think that the people who don't recognize this early, mm-hmm. it's going to be like, Apple stock, or IBM or Microsoft,
Or Bialy
stock. It's like why? Bialy stock. Why couldn't I have gotten in on the ground floor of that? Of course it seems really early now and you seem like crazy. Everyone who invests in something early seems crazy.
Yeah.
It's just a tip. That's my Sunday. It's Sunday morning, right? Isn't that when like pundits give tips?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's 2050. The fish are gone. Where will we eat?
In reality, the cannibalism is only going to be like a secondary symptom of something else that's going to happen. And that is
Donald Trump being president?
Well, it does relate to delusion.
Yeah.
So, that human beings live in a delusion.
Yes.
And our main delusion is our superiority.
Yes.
And our supremacy on the planet. And we talk about us being the top of the food chain like it's a given. And we brag about that. Of course, we think of the food chain as basically like fish through mammals to us.
Yeah.
But of course, on the food chain, we're pretty freaking low.
Yeah.
If you add up all the species that can kill us and just go blithely about their business. You take single-celled organisms, parasites.
Amoebas.
Viruses. All these things are the top of the food chain.
Yeah.
They're going to waste. They've been around before us. They'll be around after us. We're a blip on their radar. As soon as we become yummy enough, they're going to eat us. And when they start eating us and cause the total decay of civilization.
You're talking about zombie right now. You're talking about the virus.
Yeah, we went to zombie real fast.
I'm not talking about zombie virus. I don't believe in zombism that's going to happen. I believe that we are going to just become the victims of predators beyond our control, beyond our technology and our ability to adapt and evolve biologically, that they're going to be superior to us. And that's going to create, along with other man-made factors, a collapse in civilization that's going to result to incredible food shortages. That's going to result in cannibalism. It's not zombie cannibalism. It's a cannibalism of the need to survive.
Yeah.
And that's going to happen. And if you don't get in now by calling 1-800-555-EAT-ME.
Amazing. Moving on. Did you actually?
And the other thing. Wait, one other thing about this
yes.
is that it's really funny how we have to disguise our relationship to food, because we need to really never think of ourselves as potentially food. So aside from like Ted Nugent and a few other people out there who really, or maybe Anthony Bourdain, who really want to know what they're eating and kill it themselves, we need to eat things that have a very subtle glaze on them. They're served on a plate in a shape that doesn't represent much of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the closer it is to us biologically, the further removed its presentation usually wants to be.
Yeah.
And so, of course, not for most people, not a lot of people listening to this are really involved in food, and they probably don't count in this. But I think, of the great majority of people, the 300 million Americans or so, most of them need their food to not resemble its animal form. And that's because that leads back to them being an animal and knowing
their own mortality and vulnerability.
It's all about fear of death.
Can you imagine?
All eating, all restaurants, everything is about fear of death.
Yes.
And that is my Tinder date profile.
Can you imagine me glazed on a plate? Do you think I look delicious?
All I can say is please leave the head on.
Yeah.
And the cheeks look really, really sweet.
Ooh, thank you. Ooh. Can you tell me a little bit about, maybe after this we'll talk about, some music stuff, he has some pretty interesting stories about musicians and stuff, and playing around the world in Japan, but what about your bar?
Right.
What's going on?
Right. Well, I
this
feel
man,
like
this man's a great legal mind too. He had precedents. He set precedents in liquor law across the world.
Yeah, it's funny how
he's actually opening up a bar inside of an elementary school. And actually, he's
no, yeah. it's a Catholic elementary
oh,
school.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's funny when weird elements of your pontificating life mm-hmm. come together, and you know, having even though I came from a family that had a prehistory of being quite Eastern Orthodox a Christian, my grandparents, I was raised basically as an atheist and developed into a somewhat what they might call a militant atheist. So battles, you know, separation of church and state has always been an important issue. So that led me to open a bar. No, I'm and also the idea of like two things. One is the idea that you don't have to do the same thing with your life entirely all the time. It doesn't mean giving up other things that you do, but you know, I always feel like I need to do something slightly I need to sort of I don't know. I'm not going to say push myself because that I hate people who say that.
Yeah.
But just to spread yourself too thin to be really accused of not being good enough at anything. That's what I want to say.
Yeah.
you said Renaissance man. I said when you spread yourself too thin that you can't be, you know, you can cover your mediocrity in everything with doing a lot of things sort of okay.
Yeah. Well, you know. Besides David Bowie, you know who the master of that was fucking Moni. Moni from Alioli.
David Moni. That should be our David Bowie cover band.
Yeah, exactly. David Moni.
David Bowie.
No, it's my friend. It's my friend Moni. He's from Turkey, but he was like a translator and an artist, and he was like selling paintings. And then he said, "Fuck art, fuck translating. I'm going to start making women's handbags." He starts making handbags. He has showrooms in New York, London, and Japan. And then he said, "Fuck handbags." Then he started opened a restaurant, which, in my opinion, I think is maybe one of the great restaurants that has ever existed in this world.
It was truly a great restaurant.
It was truly a great restaurant in every way. And like I still, at least once a month, somebody comes up to me and says it's still my favorite restaurant.
I must say,
New York.
A lot of the greatness of that restaurant was because of Mr. Gilmore, who turned it into more than just a place with really good food, but like a real place where interesting people would always be at. You didn't need to make a plan; you could spontaneously walk in there, and something interesting would happen. Someone, if you didn't know someone, you'd get introduced to somebody, and it's what makes Momo such a great restaurant. The same thing happens there.
Yeah.
Like if I ever feel like I'm lonely and no one loves me and I'm going to grow old watching TV, eating SpaghettiOs out of a can and a wife beater. The first thing I would do to combat that would be I would go to Momo and sit there and look dejected, and he would somehow bring me back to the real world through introducing me to people or creating some sort of social situation that reminds you of almost the way like cafe life should be, where interesting people should have to talk to each other and not just stare blankly at the floor because they're too shy to reveal that they're not as cool as they may think they are.
Aww. Phil is one of the great hosts. That's what Patrick always says about you. He says you're the greatest.
Can we talk about me?
You've got greatness.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
We actually have another 25 minutes to talk about you.
Yes, okay. Let's start with my eyebrows.
Born in a log cabin in Illinois.
Actually, Philip born in Wichita,
poor black.
Moni though. But that, you know, like kind of to what you were saying, it's like Moni like didn't. There's nothing that defines him because he's just like okay, fuck it. He closed Alioli and then moved to Turkey and does real estate now. He's just like. You know, but I love that about our lives is that, you know, tomorrow I can decide that I'm going to be this.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
I got to get his number.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I want to go.
I'm thinking about going to Turkey.
Are you really?
Yeah, I want to go.
I want to go too.
Yeah.
Let's go.
I've never been. I was supposed to go in October of 2001.
Are you scared?
That got postponed due to the greatest calamity ever to befall humanity.
Yeah.
Which is 9/11. I was like, just don't cancel my flight.
Yeah.
I want to go to a Muslim country.
Yeah, exactly.
That hates Armenians.
Yeah, exactly. and Jews.
And Jews, yeah, really. can't hide.
Yes. There was one last man alive. He was going to complete Operation Nemesis.
Eat me alive.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and take a short break. And then we'll be back. Yeah.
A little breaky poo.
A little breaky poo. And then we'll be back with Gary Allen.
You've already broken me. I'm yours.
French Entrance by Teeth People. You're listening to The Main Course. We'll be right back.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Welcome back to The Main Course. We are speaking with Gary Ellen, and a nice little break with Edwards. We were just talking about for a moment.
Yes, if you don't know them, they're probably the greatest producer of hams in maybe the United States. Yeah. One of the best in the world. I mean, they're just like the best, but the whole thing burnt down. Is that true?
Yeah. So they had a catastrophic fire at their facility in Surrey, Virginia. Four generations of cure masters in that family. Like they've been doing it for over 90 years. But something happened.
Did the masters survive?
No one was hurt.
Okay. What about the pigs?
The pigs had already seen their fate.
Oh, so no free barbecue.
No. Yeah. Probably smell good.
That's I was saying they should do like an eBay drive and like dig some of the hams out of the fire and, you know, sell them. I would hams. Without a doubt eat one. But they do a great thing that we actually serve at Moku Moku. It's Surrey, Virginia. So they do a Serrano style ham that they call it Suriano.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and they age it for 400 days, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's phenomenal. Yeah.
I speaking of cannibalism, you know, the pig is a very close relative to the human.
Yeah.
And in intrauterine gestation photography of a chicken, a fish, a human, and a ham, you cannot, at some point the fish drops out, at some point the chicken drops out, they become obviously not a human fetus. You cannot tell the difference between the pig fetus and the human fetus till just about when they're born.
Is it true?
We're so closely related. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Intelligent, organ compatible. I mean, really. What a maligned animal for being so close to us. I somehow made a spontaneous hoof gesture with my hands.
He literally, for those that aren't in the studio, he actually literally had his hands like hooves.
I love swine, and I especially love saying wild boar in Italian.
How do you
say
that?
Cinghiale.
Cinghiale.
It's a terrible accent.
Yes.
But it's such a great word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us about the bar. You're doing it with Richie.
Yeah, so I would never, as a total amateur in the food or restaurant bar business, I would never have the hubris to try and open a place unless I had a vetted professional to really run it and know what they're doing.
Do you know about three times a year somebody will come to me and ask me my advice, and every time I tell them
don't do it.
No, well they say don't do it or find a Richie. That's my number, because people really think, especially restaurants are a little bit more complex, but bars people think this is how it works. I order the beer and then I hook it up to the keg. I pour the beer. I give them the beer. They give me the money. I go home and deposit all the money in the bank. You forget that people like smash bottles in people's faces. You forget that people OD in the bathroom. You forget that somebody slips on an ice cube and breaks their face. You forget that there's, you know, a thing called alcoholism and your staff steals from you. There's a billion things that people don't realize. It's not just as simple as so.
I think with anything that you have a fantasy of doing, maybe.
Yeah.
A lot of people have this with music, and it's very easy to have. You watch somebody,
exactly.
You watch Segovia playing the guitar, and you're like, oh my God, that's so cool. I want to buy a guitar and get lessons, learn how to do that. But, you know, it's like there got to be things in every individual's life with the fantasy of doing something else that they understand how complex and hard they would be to do, and they realize that if someone came to them and said, "Hey, I want to learn to do what you do. I've got like 3 hours every other Wednesday," you'd look at them and you'd laugh and kick them the fuck out, right? Yeah. But like, so for some reason, a lot of amateurs feel like they can open a restaurant because they eat or drink.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only thing I've got going for me is knowing that that's actually impossible.
Yeah.
You know, so that was never mind.
But you're a little you're a step ahead of most of the idiots in this world, because you aside from hanging out in bars and restaurants, you also do know a lot of restaurant and bar owners. You have been behind the scenes
lot. I've listened to the late night words of fear and complaint from people
exactly.
who work in the industry,
and you're still
and
doing.
I've taken them to heed.
Yeah.
I've heeded those words. But Richie Boccato owns a great bar called Dutch Kills, and I've been the head bartender at Milk and Honey and Little Branch, and was a protege of Sasha Petrovsky, and you know, and a great guy who I've known for years, who grew up in Brooklyn. We knew all the same petty thugs as children, and I really like him. And you know, the situation happened that I was living in a ground floor commercial space in Williamsburg when the city encouraged people to do that because it was a bombed out terror zone, And then as soon as it became have any kind of value, the Honorable Mayor Giuliani and Bloomberg saw fit to kick us all out and took a sledgehammer to my nice apartment and had a vacant space. And I thought, well, you know what? Maybe we'll put a business in here. And I thought the only business that I knew anybody who knew anything about was maybe opening a bar. And this was after 2008 of the financial crisis, the music business was in a tailspin. There was almost no work, and I was thinking, I need a new job. And I realized I was only qualified for possibly doing minimum wage labor, some construction work, and being a frou-frou musician.
Mm-hmm.
So those were my options. And I spent about 2 years wandering around the streets with very little work, trying to think of how I was going to reinvent myself, and that was it. And then we got...
And taking your squash skills and playing ex-prisoner's eye for money on the handball court and losing.
Yeah, I'm aging out of being able to hustle squash. Mm-hmm. And So to make a long story short, we vetted the space. It looked like we'd have no problem getting a liquor license. Deep into the process, it turned out that there was a storefront church that we had been assured would not have precluded us from getting a liquor license due to the 200-foot rule. I think that the State Liquor Authority made a very wrong decision based on stretching details to the max to give church protection to a church that normally would not have had the church protection. And so we ended up fighting this for a long time. I became basically a jailhouse SLA lawyer when we ran out of money for actual people with law degrees who had sort of given up on us pretty much. And then our representative, Joseph Lentahl, you know, we saw the problem and really felt like we had been treated wrongly and decided to help us. I out of the blue, I did nothing in it for him. And he sort of took us on as a case, and we fought to get a bill passed in legislation, granting us an exception based on what we thought was this incorrect ruling. And it passed the Assembly and the Senate and eventually was signed by the governor. So it was actually a bill, a law, granting us an exception to the 200-foot rule that took years of fighting, and it was a kind of a miracle. You know, everyone had given up on it, and I just really, I had my fangs stuck into this, you know, hyena that wouldn't go down.
Yeah.
And it was dragging me all over Africa.
Yeah.
And I was like an idiot. I was like, I'm not letting go. And it was like, well, you can't kill me. And I was like, I'm not letting go, and you can't kill me. And then, you know, I thought that's how my life was going to end.
Yeah.
Just in a stalemate, you know.
Yeah.
And So
now let's when will the bar be open, do you think?
Well, we're waiting on some paperwork from the city. It's basically finished.
Hopefully, oh, no, not again.
Hopefully this month. You know, the city moves the city does everything they can to move quickly and facilitate you. And no, I'm just kidding. No, I'm not kidding. They're really great. Wait a minute. What am I saying? They're not going to hear this.
They're not, no. What,
no. Obviously, there's going to be an amazing cocktail
soon,
program.
In February.
Talk to me about the food.
Well, we're really, since we're opening on basically vapors of, of money.
Yeah.
Because it's been taking such a long process and had to spend so much money on things that really weren't going into. You know, we're really going to focus on the cocktails when we first open. Yeah. We're going to have sort of a minimal food program. But we really hope to develop that, you know, and really want to use – there's so much good food being made by people who are local to us. Great bakeries, great, you know, all sorts of things around here. That, you know, we're not going to really have a kitchen, a full kitchen. Mm-hmm. But we want to try and find, like, the best simple food that we can get and have brought in from other places. And then
I gotta take you whenever you're ready. We'll walk it with Heritage Foods. It's just around the corner, and they have 5 walk-in refrigerators, and like it's the best, definitely the best pork you can buy.
They should reserve one of those for humans in the future.
Get out of here. This is the third time the cannibalism. This is the third time on a show that we've been talking
about
cannibalism.
I've never really thought about cannibalism really much before like driving over here without coffee in me.
Patrick, I'm sorry that I took your dream and this show and turned it into a show about cannibalism. I'm Patrick Martins. I'm sorry that I did this. We only have guests on. So what do you think about cannibalism? Anyways, you gotta check out Heritage Food. It's like we got.
Well, I'm counting on you for some good food advice because you're my food god.
I have some ideas for.
I've never eaten anything off of your hand that I wouldn't like walk through a desert to eat.
Oh, good times.
I saw that gesture once at a Bugs Bunny.
Oh, really?
What are the details of the where is it? What's it?
So
called?
It's located at 161 Grand Street, which is Grand just off of Bedford, between Bedford and Barry. And
the central fucking
nerve. It's in a little 3-story house that that me and my now ex-wife, Jesse Moore, who's a partner.
Hi, Jesse. We love you.
Who's a partner in the business, bought in the early 90s and lived in for years and lived in that space for years with my apartment. And so it's a very personal kind of space. And the bar, it's you know, because of Richie, and it's, you know, and we're going to be sharing a lot of staff from Dutch Kills and a lot of things from Dutch Kills. You know, we've named it Fresh Kills Bar. It's, you know, sort of a cousin bar, and it's an homage to the greatest landfill in the history of the United States, possibly the world, maybe minus Bangladesh, and you know,
you can see it from space.
Yeah.
And the vapors.
We're going to name it the great Pacific Island, floating island of junk.
Yeah,
but that was actually already taken. Yeah. Sorry,
Tiki bar concept. you know what? I'd like to hear the story again. I think I've only heard it once, but it's one of the greatest stories I've ever heard. So Garo was in a band, and I knew Garo for about 6 or 7 years when we were getting drunk one day, and he was mentioning this band, and it was the band Para Ubu, which he was in the band Para Ubu. And when I was 15, I was like, that was my favorite band. I did like the music, but it was like nobody else had heard of Para Ubu, so I liked them because nobody else had heard of them. And you know that thing when you're 15. But can you tell the story when you went to East Berlin?
Oh, yeah.
This is a great story.
Yeah, actually.
Have you ever heard of Para Ubu?
No.
They're a great band.
Actually, the East Berlin story was with another band. It was called The Ordinaires, which was a great New York band.
I thought it was with Para Ubu.
No, we spent a lot of time in Europe.
Are you sure? Because I remember this story very well, the one time that I heard it. I'm pretty sure.
Hold on just a moment.
I'm pretty sure it was Para Ubu.
Let's make sure we're talking about the same story. But I'm not really. This is
the thing with money.
Yeah. I remember. So, yeah, that was The Ordinaires.
Okay.
And, you know,
or maybe Para Ubu, but you know, we're not
going to fight about it.
One of us is right.
Find The Ordinaires somewhere. We were the Ordinaires was a 9-piece, really, really a great band in New York. When the Knitting Factory first opened, we played there weekly. We you know, had a pretty big following. All our shows were sold out here, and this is in the mid late 80s to the early 90s, and when MTV was first beginning, and somehow at one point we used to do a cover of Kashmir before people did a cover of Kashmir.
Yeah.
There was this kind of wall of sound, incredible thing, and we made a video of it out in Jones Beach, and it somehow got into rotation on early MTV.
Really?
Because they had 6 videos on their shelf, and we were the 7th.
Yeah.
And so it got played like 1 million times, and it became kind of like We got sort of known a little internationally. We started touring all over the world and playing these crazy shows, and people didn't know if we were... I mean, it's really a rock band, but no singer. Mm-hmm. So in Europe, they would think you were a jazz band and book you into the Berlin Jazz Festival mm-hmm. or the Holland Fest or things like that, and then we'd play rock clubs, and it was great. It was a real variety of stuff, and we spent a lot of time in East Germany before the wall came down, which was a fascinating experience, because once you get outside of the show place of East Berlin, I say that with a little quote, in the air
with little pink hooves.
Ew, gross, I just did that. But when you get out into, like, you know, Mainz and you know, Stuttgart, you know, other Leipzig, other cities like that, which were really, you know, impoverished, you know, Eastern German Soviet, you know, you go by the grocery store, there'd be one what looked like an irradiated mangled lemon in the window, and a line of 100 people fighting for that lemon, which probably had more cesium in it than whatever, making that up. But and we got paid. We're playing shows all over. The great shows, weird slam dancing people, and, you know, playing in unfinished train tunnels, and you know, the weirdest things that you can imagine, and getting paid.
And you're there kind of illegally, kind of.
I think we somehow. I'm not really sure of the legality. It was legal, yeah. I think. If it was illegal, I'm glad I didn't know it at the time. Yeah. Two things happened. One is, I remember I was standing on a street corner, and like a New Yorker, of course, I took two steps off of the sidewalk onto the street, when all of a sudden I felt a smack on the back of my shoulder. Someone grabbed me by the back of my jacket and literally yanked me back onto the sidewalk. And I turned around, and it must have been an 80-year-old German woman who pulled me back and looked at me with the sternest look I've ever gotten, and then pointed across the street at two Stasi-looking East German police officers and just looked at me and wagged her finger at me like this and just went, nine.
Oh, like jaywalking?
Like, do not step off the curb. You go to prison and no one ever hears from you again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, that was one story. The other one was, I'd amassed a lot of East German money somehow, East German marks, which had no exchange rate.
Yeah.
So they're worthless. You can paper your wall, the souvenir, but you couldn't buy a thing in any other country than East Germany with it. So, you know, as we were getting towards the end of the tour, we started, like, realizing that, like, this money was really not, you know, not worth anything, but it probably meant a lot to people there.
Yeah.
Started trying to give it away. And at one point, I remember trying to give some away on the street, and someone literally almost beat me up for trying to hand them money, assuming that I was, like, a plant trying to, like, entrap them.
Yeah.
So no one would take any. I do remember in concerts throwing it in the air, throwing it out to people, and they would take it there because it was kind of anonymous and dark,
yeah.
And there'd be like a sort of like piranha feeding frenzy for these East German marks. And as you get to the border when you're leaving, there are people by the border, people who really are willing to take the chance, and they know that when whoever's there is leaving, they can't take the money with them, yeah. And often that's a good place to
hit people up.
To hit people up in a bag or whatever, and we ended up, like, you know, probably giving away like thousands and thousands of dollars of money that we couldn't really use.
Is that how they were paying you on your tour? Like, the clubs were, like, paying you in a currency?
I almost feel like it's a trick thing. It's like getting paid in Monopoly money. Yeah. But, I mean, when you're there, sure, you eat in the best restaurant, which has the semi-less irradiated lemon. You stay in the best hotel, which has, you know, which has a bed with fewer bloodstains in it. And, you know, you spend as much money as you can on your lifestyle when you're there. But that doesn't nearly cover it because everything wasn't really very expensive. So.
You know, in my mind, when, you know, you're throwing money to the crowd, I always, in my mind, I imagine they're bearer bonds and they're pieces of paper that are like, you know, 8x11, you know, for some reason, bearer bonds.
It was much closer to Monopoly money.
Yeah. What is a bearer bond?
I don't know. Is it edible?
Bearer bond is completely anonymous currency.
It's a note that's
completely untraceable. For whatever reason, it's good for its value.
I think it's the big brother of the Bialystok.
Yeah, be careful. They probably have chips in them now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. When in the future, you're not going to be able to get, you know, when you want to ransom off a kidnapped victim that you've taken, really, bearer bonds might be tricky because they're going to put RF chips in them, you know, little tip.
Did you find any bearer bonds in the moldy, dusty cabinet? Ooh.
The moldy cabinet.
The moldy bearer bonds cabinet.
That's the name of Phillip's new restaurant.
Yeah, the moldy cabinet. next
Phillip's moldy cabinet.
It's right next door to the Pacific Ocean junk pile on Grand Street.
It has hams that were only burnt naturally in fires.
Yes, exactly. Hope we're almost out. Time to start another fire.
But I did play with Perubu for a number of years and tour around the world, and there are crazy Perubu stories.
Yeah.
A lot of them involve David Thomas, who is one of the greatest performers of all time because he is fearless, you know, balls of steel, and willing to put the lives of his band members up for just the slightest bit of stagecraft.
Yeah.
Having survived that tour, I feel lucky. I feel like I made it out of Afghanistan.
What year did you...
My stint in Rikers didn't involve in permanent damage.
What year did you tour with them?
It was kind of in the mid-90s. Yeah. And one great story, it was actually in America. I remember, I think we were playing in Philly. I think it was the Chestnut Cabaret in Philly. Mm-hmm. And he came out on stage, and everyone's screaming, sold out, and he... He walks out and goes to the microphone and he goes, you know, I'm only paraphrasing. He said it much better than I could ever. But he's like, Philly, you know, we're glad to be in Philly tonight. But, you know, you all know, I know that, you know, Philly's no Boston. And for fuck's sake, Boston's no New York. And you know, third rate city at best, probably.
And oh, no.
The look on the people's faces, which was utter joy and screaming and hysteria and anticipation, seeing that turn in a second to the nine stages of grief or whatever they are, and then landing on anger and sitting on it. And they were just screaming and throwing stuff and whatever. And right at that moment, David turns his back to the audience, looks right at us, and we're all equally horrified, and says, okay, boys, you have 90 minutes to win them back.
Amazing.
He then proceeded over the next 90 minutes to totally fucking win them back. Like, it is unbelievable that, like, you know, the balls of steel and the ability to pull that off as stagecraft. You
and
know?
Anyways, it was premeditated.
It was. I don't know how premeditated it was. I think what's premeditated
brilliant.
Is I'm going to go out and do the worst possible fucking thing ever.
Yeah,
it's premeditated. You know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Garo, thank you so much for stopping by and hanging out with us.
Do we have to stop?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I booked the whole afternoon.
Oh, yeah. This is awkward.
You have to be somewhere at 2:45. What will you do today in Harlem?
I have a haircut.
Do you really? Yeah. In Harlem?
No. I was at high school in Harlem.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well,
stories for next time.
I love this.
Yeah,
it was so much fun.
You're 100%. I'm going to have you on again because I didn't even.
Everybody
didn't,
cool.
Yeah.
Who's lucky enough to get an invitation to this? Should come do this.
Let's get Richie on. I want Richie to come too.
He'll never do it.
Why? Really?
Because he totally eschews all things like that. He's private, man. He's like the great bear hermit. No, I'm going to try and talk him into doing
awesome.
It.
Awesome. Cool.
Yeah. He would be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, awesome. I love you both.
I love you both.
Cheers. Happy Sunday.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.